Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. When F. Scott Fitzgerald published The Great Gatsby in 1925, some reviewers declared the novel a dud. During that first year, it sold only 20,000 copies. And by the time Fitzgerald died at the age of 44 in 1940, he was pretty much unknown to many, and his novel practically forgotten. But over the years, of course, The Great Gatsby has become an American classic. And today, the book still sells a 500,000 copies a year. It inspires plays and movies, including a new one starring Leonardo DiCaprio, which opens nationwide this weekend.
New York, 1922. The tempo of the city had changed sharply. The buildings were higher. The parties were bigger. The morals were looser and the liquor was cheaper.
Fitzgerald's novel has also inspired an opera, which will have its Boston premiere this weekend. Emmanuel Music will perform The Great Gatsby this Sunday at the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall. So how do you make a novel like Gatsby sing? Well, here to answer that question is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Harbison and Ryan Turner, the artistic director of Emmanuel Music. And gentlemen, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Good to be
Thank
here.
You.
So, first of all, for those few listeners who didn't read the book in high school, The Great Gatsby is set in the Roaring Twenties. It tells the tragic story about the decadent downside of the American dream. And John Harbison, let me start with you. What makes this such great material for an opera?
Well, a lot of the novel is lyric description, and a lot of music is also a lyric description of some kind, a way of making feeling, communicating, change of place, things that a novel can do in connective tissue, but where music can move in.
Well, we're going to hear some of the music from the opera in a moment, but Ryan Turner, I want to turn to you and ask you the same question. Why does Gatsby offer such fertile material for movies and now for an opera?
I think part of that is a sort of benign misinterpretation of the novel that's accumulated over the years, and the kind of fascination with the tinsel and glitter of the jazz age. But underneath all of that is the kind of dark emptiness of how this kind of privileged world of inherited wealth isn't enough to truly satisfy and fulfill an individual. Mm. And I think that's at the heart of the piece, and that's part of what makes it work musically.
Well, let's listen to some of the music. Let's start with the overture, which seems to lay out various themes from this jazz age, the Roaring Twenties. You hear music, radio, party singers, and bands. Let's take a listen. John Harbison, how did you begin to take on the challenge of setting this story to music like this?
What I was really trying for in the overture was really what you said, a kind of compression of the themes.
One of the things that John is able to do in his opera, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is he interweaves these pop tunes written in the style of the 20s, but they're all John's tunes, amidst the, for lack of a better term, I guess I'd call it the psychological music of the characters. And there's one scene at the beginning of Act Two where it's a party scene, but Jay and Daisy have gone into the house while all the guests are outside of the house, and John is able to kind of create two different geographic locations within his music in one scene, so we don't have to be two places, but the music creates that scene for us.
And if they ask you, say I'm doing fine. I've made up my mind never to pine no more.
So, John, I want to just ask you about that switching back and forth between styles, between the operatic styles and the popular music styles. It came through really clearly in that piece that we just heard.
Yeah, it does. One of the things I'm doing there, though, the typical listener probably won't pick it up, is I'm using the same threads, the same melodic threads in both of the musics, and it's a kind of a subliminal connection, so that the joint is really easy to achieve. And it sounds probably more abrupt than the actual musical fabric is.
And Ryan, how do you handle that? I mean, as the artistic director, that switching back and forth between styles. What's your sort of comment about that?
Given that we're doing this opera in concert as opposed to a staged version, mm-hmm. it does help simplify things a little bit. Because in the opera, John has scored it that there's a band on stage that goes back and forth from being on stage, from being in the pit. Now, we're able to have everybody on the stage all the time and all in the same, you know, geographic region.
John Harbison, I want to ask you, we came across some really information about the history of this and sort of what you went through in writing this opera. And the idea that I came away with is that writing an opera might not be for the faint of heart. You wrote two operas in the 1970s, A Winter Tale and A Full Moon in March. And after A Winter's Tale, the head of a major opera company comes to you and says, you're a very fine composer, but we give you a scholarship not to do another opera.
Yeah, that's right.
That's pretty accurate. How do you come back from something like that?
Well, you never know in the reception history of an opera what's going to happen. The verdict sometimes comes in so slowly. And so I didn't really give up on opera, but I did give up on many certain companies at the time. But, you know, composers have never enjoyed the buffeting of the opera world too much.
Sure.
Because we spend a long time working on one of these things, and the fate of the piece can turn on very, very small factors.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you came back and persisted.
Well, I got a hint from some friend. He said, well, at least he said you're a good composer.
Yeah, right. Let's listen to another bit of music from your opera. Another challenge seems to be recreating, I don't know, the sounds, the percussion needed for this production. And so I want to listen to this excerpt. It's also from Act Two. So what instruments are we hearing there?
A whole bunch.
Yeah. That's clear.
Well, John has everything kind of as common as a xylophone, marimba, vibraphone, and as esoteric maybe as car brake drums. Hmm. We have a 1920s auga horn. There's a flexitone. There's a slapstick. There's a wide array, tubular chimes. And then, of course, there's the stage band percussionist who's most of the time playing just a simple trap set.
Fantastic. Since this opera first premiered, it's gone under various changes, fine tunings. I'm just curious, what is it about this opera, this story, that keeps it relevant and that keeps people coming back? And Ryan, let me start with you.
Well, back in the fall, we were doing some of John's music in a Beethoven concert, pairing it with Beethoven. I made the statement that one of the things that Beethoven and Harbison had in common was their willingness to be misunderstood. Hmm. And I think that's part of what has enabled John's music to stand the test of time, and that here we are about 13 or 14 years after the premiere of the piece to bring it back and hopefully give it a new light, a new hearing. And one of the things that I'm hoping is gained from a concert performance is that it puts the focus on the music.
Ryan is right that we hear what we see. Mm. It's the kind of encounter that I actually had with operas when I was just getting to know opera, which was turn on the radio and here are these amazing sounds that are not like what happens in most other music. And the listener just simply makes another kind of conclusion.
And John, you wrote this overture to this piece, as we heard, some 30 years ago. Did you imagine, did you think, did you hope that we'd be having this conversation about the performance of this opera in 2013?
That's a key question. The composer, I think, ideally learns not to hope. Hmm. because if you become too bound up in your hopes and you don't sort of trust your music to ripen or somehow sound better later, you begin to lick your wounds. And in many cases, composers have stopped working in that state of mind. I think the decision always has to be write the piece and then go on and write more pieces. And that's really the case here. I never expected all this music to come back. And so obviously I'm delighted and a little dazed by this. And what I have, I think, in return is I have lots of other music that I wrote during those years when I wasn't hoping.
Great. Well, John Harbison, John Harbison, what a pleasure. That's John Harbison. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and professor of music at MIT. He also composed the music and libretto for the opera The Great Gatsby. Thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
And Ryan Turner, artistic director of Emmanuel Music, thank you as well.
Thank you, Anthony.
Emmanuel Music will perform The Great Gatsby this Sunday at the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall. On July 11th, Emmanuel Music brings this production to Tanglewood. There's a lot more information at our website, radioboston.org. And that's it for today. Before we go, we want to say so long to Eva Aguado. For the past 5 months, she's been working very capably as our intern here at Radio Boston. She's brought us talent, good humor, and intelligence. She's graduating next week from BU. So, Eva, congratulations, good luck, and thank you. And that's it for this week. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is back on Monday. Join us then for more Radio Boston.